The first matter we have up is, let me look at my schedule here. 294, concealed handgun permits. You'll give us a brief rundown, please, Mr. Pound.
For the record, I'm Jim Pound, Staff Senator Taylor. Alaska's concealed carry law has been the most successful program in the United States. That success is based in part on the original intent of the legislation to allow only knowledgeable, law-abiding citizens to obtain state permits to carry concealed handguns. Although the program has been successful, there are several recurring problems with the implementation and the management. SB 294 has been worked on since the original wording to fine-tune it even more, and is before you now as a CS. CS for SB 294 proposes statutory changes to improve and streamline the process to obtain and renew a concealed handgun permit. Applicants will no longer be required to have a sworn application. Permit holders will be allowed to submit their renewal applications 60 days prior to expiration. Currently, it's 30 days. This will allow more time to complete the renewal process before the actual expiration date. A new photograph will be required every 7 years, equaling to essentially 10 years instead of every 5 years as they are right now, same thing as we have for our state driver's licenses. An additional thumbprint for renewal will no longer be required based on the concept that your thumbprint should never change. The bill also makes some changes to the training and education statutes. It will be streamlining that process and making it easier for us to deal with other states. The applicant will be required to provide evidence of completion of a handgun or firearm safety course, but it will eliminate the more subjective requirement by eliminating the specific statutory definition of competence, which is causing problems, again, with some of the other states. Alaska State Troopers now will be authorized by statute to help teach handgun courses. This should be able to generate some additional revenue. CS for SB 294 makes the statute apply equally to all citizens statewide and clarifies the standards for recognition of permits from other states. CS for SB 294 streamlines and improves the program that has been in place and will continue to be a success in Alaska. Thank you.
Mr. Dave, do we have a motion to adopt the proposed committee substitute?
You're making that motion?
If you want.
Yes. It's been a motion to adopt the committee substitute. That's work draft lockup G. Is there objection? There being no objection, it's adopted. Let me first turn to Mr. Gunn. Victor, did you have a proposed amendment to the CS?
For the record, my name is Victor Gunn, and I'm here on my own behalf today as a retired deputy chief of police with 24 years of law enforcement experience. First, I'd like to say that I've seen the CS and I wholeheartedly endorse all of the changes that are in it. Through my other job, I've talked to some of the firearms instructors who teach these classes, and they are also have been requesting these. There was a hearing that Senator Taylor did not too long ago where that testimony is available. The reason I'm here today is this kind of came up a little kind of quickly, but I wanted to offer to the committee the opportunity to exempt law enforcement officers by the statute from carrying concealed weapon or by carrying concealed weapons. Right now, there are if you're out of your jurisdiction, you would have to have a CCW permit unless you're a state trooper or your jurisdiction statewide or you're a federal officer. I think that there is a federal pending legislation that would do this at the federal level for all states. And you have in front of you some of that language on carrying of concealed weapons by qualified law enforcement officers. I'd like to suggest that we incorporate this language into ACS as conceptual amendment. I would have had this prepared in state form if I had more time, but we just didn't do it. You see there's two sections here, carrying and concealed firearms by qualified law enforcement officers. Essentially, it just exempts certified police officers in the state of Alaska carrying concealed wherever they're at. Also, as you see in the federal law, they were going to exempt retired police officers, and there are, on page 2, some caveats to that. you have to have retired from a identified agency under their retirement system, such as the state of Alaska PERS, and you have to have been with them for a certain period of time, and you can't be prohibited by law from carrying one for all the other reasons regular citizens are. So I offer these as a conceptual amendment to this bill and would be happy to answer any questions reference that.
Thank you. Chair, to entertain a motion.
Chairman, I don't particularly support the second half of this, but I don't have any problem with active law enforcement officers being able to carry concealed statewide. So, I mean, if this is, of course, this is all out of form. It's not in
right.
state form. But I'd move a conceptual amendment to authorize any duly authorized Alaskan law enforcement officer to be able to carry concealed anywhere in the state of Alaska.
Could I address that, Mr. Chairman? On the retired part, I hate to use myself as an example, but the day I retired from Fairbanks Police Department, I had to comply, just as every other citizen does, with getting a permit. I don't have a problem with that. I'm happy to do it, and I'm glad the law is there to allow you to do it. However, after 20-something years of law enforcement experience, and in my particular case, I was a certified police firearms instructor in both pistol, revolver, shotgun, rifle, chemical weapons, taught police for years in this matter, certified by the state. At the officers level, who have been doing this for 20 years, everywhere in this state, they're required to qualify, minimum annually, most departments like Fairbanks, minimum of 4 times a year. The bare necessity going into this, and when they've retired, they've had a tremendous amount of firearms experience, and they've had an awful lot of classroom experience and the use of deadly force. So I thought that this would be something that we could do for the officers who have served the state of Alaska for the time necessary to retire, and that's why I was offered as an amendment.
The motion before us is that of a conceptual amendment to allow, basically page one, existing law enforcement officers to carry. Is there objection to that conceptual amendment? There being no objection, that amendment is adopted. As concerns the second one, I think, Vic, we probably all have some concerns about the retired officer who some years later, may have retired 8-10 years ago, might have to at least have some additional, or have the same type of background check or other things that would have to be part of it. I would recommend that you might work with, I'll work with you and with my staff to see if we can come up with a modification, and if not done here, because I'd like to see this move forward, we could take it up at the next committee.
Sure, and I don't have a problem with that. There are provisions in that section that cover some of your concerns.
Right, and I'm aware of it.
Thanks, sir. Thanks, Commissioner.
I have two other bills that I need to get to, and I've only got about 5 minutes to do that within, and I would at least like to adopt the committee substitutes in those bills so that we have them available for discussion. And I know Senator Torgerson's time is limited as he has to run back up to finance. And I have a whole series of witnesses out there who wish to testify, I'm assuming both for and against 294. But let's put that aside at this point, and we have a committee substitute prepared on Senator Lehman's bill, committee substitute joint resolution number 15. Would you like to give us a brief rundown on that, Mr. Pollack?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mike Pauley, staff aide to bill sponsor Senator Lehman, and in recognition of the fact that some members have to get off of finance, I'll just be exceptionally brief and just state that, as members of the panel are aware, there have been several legislative proposals over the last several years to reform Alaska's judiciary, and while they varied in the particulars, all these reform proposals stem from a common premise which is a belief that the Alaska judicial system is broken. The fundamental problem is the fact that we have judges who are not interpreting the law, but actually are writing the law. They are examining our laws and the Constitution not on a basis of original intent or longstanding legal traditions, but rather based on personal biases and contemporary political fads. Many Alaskans have taken some comfort in the fact that erroneous decisions are able to be overridden through the process of constitutional amendment. However, that process was significantly undermined in the 1998 decision in Best versus Ulmer, in which the court prevented Alaskans from voting on one constitutional amendment and edited the language of another. Mr. Chairman, the amendment before you proposes modest changes to our judicial selection process. It expands the pool of talent from which the governor can make appointments to fill judicial vacancies. It would require legislative confirmation of those judicial nominees, and it would provide for more frequent retention elections. SGR 15 takes a small step towards restoring a system of checks and balances among our three branches of government. The need for this was reflected in a comment by the 12th Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, Harlan Fiske Stone, who lived from 1872 to 1946. Justice Stone observed, "While unconstitutional exercise of power by the executive or legislative branches of the government is subject to judicial restraint, the only check on our own exercise of power is our own sense of self-restraint."
Mr. Pauly, I'm looking at your CS. The CS appears only to speak to retention elections. I didn't see any expansion of the pool from which judges might be selected.
Yeah, just to clarify, Mr. Chairman, I was speaking to the original SGR 15, not the since the committee has not actually adopted that. I felt for
my
the record.
My premise is I'd like to get the CS at least adopted to sure. What we have before us.
And that,
does
that
the sponsor
includes,
have objection to the CS?
Mr. Chairman, we've reviewed the CS and the sponsor has no objection.
Okay. Senator Donnelly.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to move a version of the CS to be adopted by the committee. I noticed in the materials for the court system, three other states have a system. The Supreme Court there is confirmed every 6 years and the Superior Court every 4 years. So what I'd like to do is move the CS, but in a version which conforms with the way Arizona, Kansas, and Oklahoma do it, which is that the Supreme Court would be subject to retention elections every 6 years and the Superior Court every 4 years. So I'd move that CS. That's very simple. It's all right there.
Discussion of the motion? Any objection? Being no objection, the motion is adopted, and that would adopt the committee substitute, which is G, lockup, with the amendment in it of modifying and putting in the word six every 6 years after Supreme Court justice, and that would then the rest of the sentence would remain the same, Mr. Tomley, because...
Yeah, I'd say it would remain the same as the existing Constitution, just substitute four for six after this in the Superior Court. That's why.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Pauly. Anything further? All right. I'd like to move on now to Senate Bill 233, Medical Assistance Liens and Claims. We have a pending committee substitute, which is lockup D. Chair to entertain a motion to adopt.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
There being a motion, is there objection to that motion? There being no objection, it is adopted. Could you give us very briefly what this bill's about? Because I'd like to have something on the record.
Yes, for the record, I'm John Sherwood with the Division of Medical Assistance. This bill would make two improvements to the medical assistance statute. One, it would bring extend the length of time providers who have claims for services provided to Medicaid recipients have to file those claims and get paid from 6 months to a year. This would bring us in conformance with industry practice. At the same time, it would change the statute to allow, if we find a good cause, for filing after the deadline to pay the full amount of the claim instead of 50% of the claim. We think that's fair. If they provided the service, they should be paid. The other area, it would improve our ability to recover against third parties where we paid for medical care for a Medicaid recipient. And then the recipient, for example, was engaged in litigation against an insurance company or some other defendant. It gives us the right to put a lien against those settlements and also imposes some additional reporting requirements of the recipient and the recipient's attorney, and creates a hardship exemption if collecting the lien would cause a hardship to the recipient. Kind of in a nutshell, that's what it does. I can answer questions if you need them, whenever.
I do have a couple questions on page 3, where we're dealing with the state having the right to receive subrogation back against a third party that may have damaged someone, and we've had to pay the cost of their medical. We've got a notice requirement there upon not only the recipient, but also their attorney.
Yes.
They're required to notify, and then we've got a paragraph in here that says, notwithstanding the assertion or failure to assert a medical claim, that the department could bring suit on behalf of the injured third party. What if that third party's already settled? Are you going to be suing? I'd like to discuss that one with you further. I'll bring a bill up again at the next hearing, now that we've already had a quorum and brought it up and adopted the committee substitute, just so I can have a couple of those questions answered, and I wanted to just to highlight them for you now.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's return now to SB 294. We have people in the audience that wish to testify on that, and that was Mr. Tom Boutin.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Tom Boutin, Juneau, Alaska. This is an excellent program, concealed carry, in the 30-plus states where it's worked. Whenever it's been peer-reviewed, it's lowered the crime rate, and Alaska's program has worked at least as well as it has in any other state, and this bill just makes some technical changes, and so it's a bill everybody should certainly support, and that's all I had. Thank you.
Thank you, and you support the bill.
Yes.
Mr. Dick Bishop. Dick is not here. Lori Huguenin. I thought I saw Lori out. Okay, and Mr. Gunn has already testified. On the teleconference, we have 294. Oh, yeah, Brian Judy in Sacramento.
Hello, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Yeah, we can hear you, Brian. Go right ahead.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Hi, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This is Brian Judy. I'm the Alaska State Liaison for the National Rifle Association, speaking today on behalf of the more than 20,000 members of the NRA in Alaska. I would characterize the many changes to existing law in Senate Bill 294 as falling into three categories. First category would be relatively substantive changes. Second category would be process efficiency changes. The third category being really just one, as I understand it, technical change to the law. The technical change deals with deleting the requirement that the application be sworn and changing the crime from perjury to unsworn falsification. My understanding is that that was proposed by alleged counsel. Don't have a problem with that. The process efficiency changes, allowing troopers to participate in the course, allowing previous photos to be used on renewal and replacement as is consistent with the driver's license program, extending the time for renewal from 30 to 60 days, deleting thumbprints, and then extending the validity of expired permit if the process is delayed for some reasons. My understanding is DPS has had a number of problems because of the shortage of manpower and the volume of permits, so we would support all those changes. The three changes that I would characterize as more substantive are, first of all, changing the system or changing the language so that more out-of-state permits would be recognized in the state of Alaska. After Senate Bill 141 was passed in 97, and became law in 98, DPS created a list of about 17 states, and I believe that initial list pretty fairly reflected the legislative intent. Subse- Subsequent to that, however, it's been changed. This committee's heard about that in a previous hearing. Now I believe there's only one state, Texas, that is recognized in Alaska. And this would basically say that a permit holder from another state who is 21 years of age, who is legally able to own a handgun, and who under that other state's law has passed a fingerprint-based background check, and then has also successfully completed some type of handgun or firearm safety course, would qualify. Permits from those states would qualify. And we believe that this is a good change. It's good public policy. There have been studies that have indicated that in states which allow law-abiding citizens to carry concealed, crime goes down. And it follows that the more law-abiding citizens you have out there able to carry out their constitutional right to keep and bear arms and their natural right of self-protection, it's going to provide a benefit to society at large. The second change would be deleting the municipal opt-out provisions. Right now, under existing law, municipalities can pass ordinances, or not pass ordinances, but they can put on the ballot and then have the public vote to prohibit carrying of concealed firearms by permit holders in the community. We believe that this is unconstitutional. Article 1, Section 19 of the state constitution says that the individual right to keep their arms shall not be denied or infringed by a political subdivision of the state, nor the state.
Do you have that in the form of an amendment?
Pardon me?
Do you have that in the form of an amendment, or have we encompassed it in the bill already?
No, that is current. That's the current language in the Alaska State Constitution as adopted back in...
I know what that is. Are you suggesting that we add some language to the bill in the form of an amendment?
No, what I'm saying is that the language in the current CS, which takes away from municipalities the ability to put on the ballot and opt out of the concealed weapon permit law, is good and is consistent with the state constitution.
Okay, that's what I thought you were saying.
Yeah, okay, fine. Additionally, this is a provision that's virtually unused in the many years since this system's been in place. Only one community has attempted to opt out. That was the city of Haines in 1998, and that ballot was defeated by a 3-1 margin. The last change that this CS would make is deleting the competency requirement and the requirement that the action and calibers which a person could carry be specified on the permit. We support doing away with this. We believe it's unnecessary. If you look at all the other state laws out there, in addition to Alaska, Vermont being the extreme where you don't even need a permit to carry concealed, you look at Washington that has over 250,000 permits outstanding. They don't require any type of proficiency training or any kind of a test or course at all. And just like Alaska, there are virtually no problems with concealed weapon permit holders. Training is good. The NRA is the foremost advocate of safe and responsible firearms use. However, it should be taken on a voluntary basis. If you look at Alaska's law, you don't need to pass any kind of a course or test to carry openly. The philosophy behind this bill is that if you can carry openly, you should be able to carry concealed. There's no reason that there's no need that's being met by this requirement. And we support its deletion.
Thank you very much, Brian. We have a couple. Senator Darley had a question for you.
Hey, Brian, how long are the CCW permits good for now?
I believe they're good for 5 years now under existing law.
Well, thank you very much, Brian. We appreciate you calling in. Janie, are you on too?
Yes, I am.
We're running out of time, and people's our problem here.
Okay. Hi, this is Janie Weininger. I'm Bill Rep for the National Rifle Association. Today I'm going to be speaking to you about CS for 294. I'm also an instructor for the program, so I've had many calls over the last 5 years concerning some of the changes that we needed. Alaska residents want to know what the law is and how it applies, you know, especially to their friends and relatives coming from the other states to Alaska, and what agreement Alaska has with these other states. Initially, as to the memo from First Sergeant Don Bowman, dated March 31st, 1998, at that time there were 17 states that were listed. And so through the years, these 5 years, as many as five different heads of permits and licensing have been, there. And now the state's honored has dwindled to one state. So apparently the permit criteria interpretation has changed as department heads have changed. And as an instructor and a contact for the permit system, I would appreciate clear, concise information that could pass on to the permit holders, both in this state and those that call from other states, and I get a lot of them. The AST website does not give such information. At the current time, it lists no reciprocity agreements at all, not even the one from Texas that was testified to earlier. States that are granted reciprocity status need to be listed, and the Permits and Licensing Department needs to update the website accordingly. As to the proposed change in AS 1865-715, the demonstration of competence with caliber and action types, I don't think that we need to have that language. We need to get rid of it and use the CS language because in teaching this course for the last 5 years, we always have live fire in the courses that we teach, and so it's redundant and unnecessary to issue that certificate of competency. We need to streamline the permit process for the law-abiding citizen, and it also benefits permits and licensing alike since they're so understaffed. Issuance of the permits have been critically slow, and the process needs to be streamlined. Some of the permit holders called me and said that they applied early and they didn't receive their permits until after their initial permit had expired, and I am one of those, by the way. It's my feeling that permits and licensing was not adequately prepared for the influx of the renewals and initial applicants at the same time. Therefore, the changes to the law need to be made to facilitate and issue permits in a timely manner. I thank the committee, and please support CS for Senate Bill 294. Thank you.
Thank you, Janie. Going through the teleconference list, was there anyone else here that wished to testify on 294? Lori, did you? Go right here. Then I'll get to the teleconference site. We'll start in Ketchikan with Mr. Isley as soon as Lori Huguenin is done. Go right ahead, Lori.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, my name is Lori Huguenin. I'm the director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I'm glad I don't often have to come before the committee in opposition to testimony. Unfortunately, the network does oppose these changes, particularly the one that gives seven. I understand there's a committee substitute that gives a seven-year time limit for the photo to be taken instead of 10. We still think that's too long of a period of time. Appearances definitely change. They can change in a few months, much less when you're looking at 7 years. So that's a concern for us that we're lengthening that time. It is a concern for us that that the bill suggests taking away the competency in the different calibers and types of weapons and just replaces that with a handgun course. As you know, Senator, I don't know a lot about guns, but I do know that they are different sizes and different weights, and how you use and handle them changes with your ability to handle those different sizes and weights and the different kinds of action and reaction that they would have. So we think it's important to keep that in the bill. We don't necessarily have an opinion one way or the other about whether or not municipalities should continue to have the right to determine whether or not people in municipalities should have that right to determine whether or not concealed weapons would be carried in their municipality. But I think that it's always a good thing to give people at the local level an option of how they want their community to be. And it seems like this hasn't been taken up very often, but it's nice to have it in the law to make it available in case municipalities would like to opt out. And at that time, those are my comments.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll now turn to the network. Mr. Isley, are you on?
Yes, I am.
Elsie, how are you?
I'm fine, Robin.
Good to hear from you. We've got quite a few people yet to go through, and we're running quite late. So if you could make your comments as brief as possible, we'd appreciate it. Elsie, how do you feel about 294?
I think it's a wonderful bill, and I'd like to say to everyone that worked on it that you really came through on this one. I did have a question or two, but since I studied it over and listened to you, I don't have any more except to say go for it.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Douglas Rhodes in Glen Allen, are you on?
This is Glen Allen. Mr. Rhodes, he already had to leave.
Okay, thank you very much. David Hudson in Anchorage.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Lieutenant David Hudson with the Department of Public Safety. I'm here to testify for Committee Substitute Senate Bill 294. As you well know, sir, I was down there and testified with you prior to this date, and certainly you've done several things here which are going to be very beneficial to expedite our program, and we certainly appreciate that. One of the things that I believe I understood from the subcommittee meeting that we had earlier was that the goal of the committee, as well as of myself and the citizens of the state of Alaska, was for our citizens to be able to carry their firearms in other states so that other states would recognize the Alaska Concealed Handgun Permit. As was testified earlier in this conversation, there is currently no reciprocal agreements with other states, meaning that no other states have come forward and indicated in writing and allowed us to participate and accept the Alaska Concealed Handgun Permit in their particular states. What I'd like to suggest in a way that we can probably make that happen would be, rather than go through and change our law, which is very successful, which is very indicative of the fact that we have not had over 11,000 permits and haven't had any significant problems with any of the permit holders in our state, rather than going about and changing that and changing some of the things which have been mentioned already, it would be very beneficial to our citizens if we could put some language in our law which would say something to the effect of eliminating our standard of at least as strict. Just take that out completely and put down that a person holding a valid permit to carry a concealed handgun from another state or another political subdivision of another state, which has provided a written statement signed by their authorized representative of that state that they will accept an Alaska concealed handgun permit in their state, then we will reciprocate by taking that state's permit. That will take and eliminate any of the potentials that were so brought up. If we have a change, if I'm no longer the head of the particular permits and licensing section, we won't have to worry about any interpretation by that individual that's in that position. We'll actually have it in statute that if another state will accept our citizens' authorized handgun permit, then we will accept theirs. And that will allow the citizens of the state of Alaska to be able to carry their firearm into another state if they so desire, and thus allow other citizens of authorized states and authorized permit holders to carry their firearm here in Alaska. As I had indicated earlier, we're very pleased with the fact that we have a positive, very well thought out, and very demonstrated professional developed program in our state, and I would hate to just go through and literally change that. As an example, I contacted three of the handgun permit instructors in the state, which my records indicate teach most often, one in Fairbanks, one in the Valley, and one here in Anchorage. They all indicated to me that they felt that the competency portion, one, has not eliminated or caused anybody not to be able to qualify for an Alaska concealed handgun permit. And they also thought that it allowed self-confidence and demonstrated proficiency and a skill that they felt comfortable with as instructors. One who has testified in front of you before actually indicated to me that if we eliminate the competency requirement, he will go ahead and do that portion of the training anyway. So I think that rather than change competency and rather than change a couple of the issues in regards to the number of misdemeanors that, for instance, reduce that or change that in regards to actual person crimes, has been indicated in this particular substitute, we can get our citizens to be allowed to carry their firearms under their Alaska Concealed Handgun Permit in other states by allowing that reciprocal agreement to be signed at the level of the permit manager's area. Another thing that was brought up, and I'm confused on, I must have misunderstood, I thought it was said earlier in testimony today that we're going to change allowing from 30 days to 60 days prior to being able to apply for renewal. Our law actually allows us to apply for renewal 90 days ahead of expiration now, so I'm sure that I must have misunderstood what was said there. As far as if it was intended to change from 30 days to a larger date in regards to the fact of how long we will accept an expired permit before an actual training class needs to be, I'm fully supportive of that, and we could actually change that from what it says 30 days now to 90 days or 120 days. I don't think that a person that goes through a firearms training course is going to forget what they learned within 60 or 90 days, so we could certainly add to that, and that would make that more convenient for our citizens. The fact that you suggested eliminating the thumbprint on the renewal, as I said before, I think that's an excellent idea, and that will allow us to expedite the renewal process somewhat. The other things that really have been brought up in the changes that have been suggested, unfortunately, I don't think are really going to expedite our process much. I wish they would. I would certainly like to be more amenable to assisting our citizens in getting these permits out much quicker. As you well know, and I don't need to reiterate here, I have limited staff, and as we saw, we had the five-year plan which came up with the renewals this year, and it created quite a backlog for us. As far as the photograph issue, I'm a little confused about that. The way the law is suggested in the committee substitute would indicate that you could basically, if you had your permit for 5 years and was applying for renewal, you could provide a photograph that was taken 2 years before you ever applied for your initial application. And I think the whole idea of a photograph is not to inconvenience our citizens. It's just to allow that people change, as was indicated before, we change in our appearance. And certainly we can lengthen the time that the photograph can be taken prior to the renewal and the initial application if it would make it more convenient to our citizens from 30 days to 60 days or 90 days. But I'm not sure we want to stretch that to 7 years. I think that would probably be a mistake. In regards to changing from perjury to unsworn falsification, that fits right in with our Alaska Title 28 statute laws in regards to vehicle legislation, and I think that's definitely less cumbersome for our citizens. It won't require that they have a notarized statement. They'll be able to sign it themselves. It will save them some money and make it more convenient. I appreciate the things and the intent of the subcommittee that's going on now, and I'd like to entertain any questions that anybody might have for me.
Yeah, the only question I had on the photograph, what are we requiring right now for photographs on driver's licenses?
Mr. Chairman, to my knowledge, I guess there is a program out there that if you don't have any driving convictions or whatnot in the 5 years, that you can get a sticker to go on the back of your driver's license. You don't go down and get a new one, so you wouldn't get that photograph updated. So if I'm understanding correctly, then I guess you could literally have a photograph on a driver's license for a maximum of 10 years. And that was, of course, because of the fact the person doesn't need to go in and fill the application out. They can do it by mail. I'm not sure that we're going to eliminate that process in our handgun permit program, so I don't really think it's that cumbersome to bring in a photograph, and only one photograph would be needed, not two, as we've changed that technology as we talked about earlier.
Yeah, the bill still has two frontal view photographs in it right now, but I've noted your concerns, and we'll certainly take a look at that, Lieutenant Hudson, and on behalf of the committee, I want to thank you for the hard work and good effort you've put in on behalf of the committee, and appreciate your work very much. Dwayne Udland, are you there and available?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Senator. I'll make this real brief because I know you're running low on time. I'm representing the Alaska Association of Chiefs of Police, of which I'm the president. I'm also chief of the Anchorage Police Department. We don't have a lot of heartburn with most of the stuff in this bill. However, there are two things that do jump out at us that I'd like to touch on. One is on page starts on page 4, section 6, and it leads over to page 5, paragraph 6, where it deals with the changing of perjury to unsworn falsification. We don't really care about that, but what we do note is that it appears that you can no longer revoke a permit if somebody filed one falsely, and we think that that should be still an option under the law. And the way it's written here, you could lie on your permit, get caught, be convicted, but you wouldn't lose your permit. We don't think that's right. The other change in the law that we have is on page 7, section 12, paragraph A2, where it says that you change the law slightly in the wording, but it's significant in that the only misdemeanors that would count would be misdemeanors that are crimes against the person. And I would suggest that people who commit burglaries or commit thefts or commit other types of crimes that don't fall under 11.41, that they probably should be screened and not get a concealed weapons permit. So we would ask that the committee please take a close look at that, because I think that could be a major problem, and it would certainly water down the intent of what we think has been a pretty good bill over the past years as it's worked. So, thank you.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Dwayne, we have already taken out some of that. We're looking here at a CS we adopted. I thought they had it there and available for you in Anchorage. The unsworn falsification under the CS, page 5, line 8, still appears to me that it says the permit shall be revoked should you make such an error. Like you, I wouldn't want them to be able to lie about it and then still get their permit. So, but we're not going to have a chance to move this bill today anyhow because of loss of quorum, but I did want to get everybody's testimony down, and I appreciate your comments very much, Chief. It's nice to have you on board. Del Smith, are you online?
This is Lieutenant Hudson. Deputy Commissioner Smith, sir, had to go testify at another hearing. He's not here, and so I replaced him.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Appreciate your good work again, and thank you all for standing by. Is there anyone else on the teleconference that wished to testify on 294?
Homer has one.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, this is Pat Johnson in Homer. I'm a NRA instructor and a concealed carry instructor. And overall, I think it's a good bill. I especially liked Lieutenant Hudson's suggestion for reciprocity, as it is a continuing problem. I've heard some concern over deleting the requirements for competency at the range. 95% of my students don't really need it. And we do a lot of dry firing in class with dummy ammunition, at least 3 different sessions. And I can pick out who knows how to handle a firearm, who doesn't. I personally won't sign off a certificate if I'm uncomfortable for a person's attitude or if I don't feel they have the ability, and I would still take a beginner or someone else out to the range and make sure they knew how to handle this. I am for these changes in Senate Bill 294. I think it will help considerably.
Well, thank
you. I have.
Thank you very much, and appreciate your patience in standing by also. I will note for those here and on the teleconference that I've taken notes on Lieutenant Hudson's concept, and we're going to try to write something into the bill for that purpose. I think it makes good sense. With that, we will move on to Senate Joint Resolution number 15, and we've had people patiently waiting an hour now to testify on that one. Judge Rabinowitz, Stephanie's going to testify in your place. Okay, Stephanie.
No, she's going first.
Okay, Stephanie, you're up.
Thank you, Senator Taylor. Could I clarify first on the CS, the resolution currently reads has to do with Supreme Court justices. It would take retention periods to 6 years and Superior Court judges to 4 years. Is that correct?
That's the only change that I know of that it makes.
Okay. And the other provisions? Okay.
All gone.
Well, Senator Taylor, thanks for hearing from me today. The odd position for me to be talking to you solely with regard to issues related to the judiciary, but I'm pleased that you're willing to hear them. I am Stephanie Cole, Administrative Director of the Court System, and I'm here on behalf of the Court to talk about the provisions in this now CS. I'll start by saying that the retention system that we currently have in place in Alaska is often cited as a national model, a model that balances judicial accountability against judicial independence, preserving a judge's ability to make decisions impartially against the public's very important right to hold their judges accountable. I know that judicial accountability is a concern to the legislature, and it's a concern to the court, too. And really, when you talk about judicial accountability, we're talking about 3 things: political accountability, decisional accountability, and behavioral accountability, and they are different. Very briefly, when we're talking political accountability, we're talking about what's accomplished through retention elections, where the public can either approve or remove judges. decisional accountability is related to the issue of whether a judge in any particular case is correct or incorrect, and usually that kind of accountability is seen to come through the appellate process. And then behavioral accountability is involved when we are dealing with judicial misconduct, and that's primarily accomplished through the judicial discipline system. And as you know, Senator Taylor, in that state, in our state, it's primarily the Commission on Judicial Conduct. Shortening the retention period that's proposed in this CS creates a situation where the line between political accountability and decisional accountability starts to blur, much to the detriment of the justice system. If you look at our position paper, you'll see that currently our merits, the periods between judicial retention elections in our state are very middle of the road. They're smack dab in the middle of where most merits election states are. If the retention periods are shortened, we're going to create a situation where a judge is under increased pressure to rule in accord with the current political or public atmosphere, whatever it happens to be at that point in time. And I know that perhaps to some people at first this doesn't appear to be a bad thing, but in fact, our whole system of government is set up to avoid that happening. While the role of the legislature may be a great deal to reflect the will of the majority of its constituents, the role of a judge is very different. One of the important obligations of a judge is to preserve and protect the rights of the minority against which the will of the majority should never be able to prevail. And this doesn't always make judges popular, and when the judge must apply the law to a set of facts without regard to political atmosphere or the will of the majority, it is a difficult and often unpopular task. When we shorten retention periods, like you're proposing to do here, it is more likely that political campaigns are going to be waged against individual judges because of single and unpopular decisions. Before I came down today, I was told a story by someone on the bench about a judge who's no longer on the bench that illustrates this. Some years ago, one of our judges was handling a very contentious case involving a school district and a teachers' union. And the issue was whether or not the teachers who had gone on strike could legally go to strike. The judge in the case ordered the teachers' staff to work, found the strike illegal, and the teachers' union vowed that when that judge was up for retention, they were going to mount a campaign to remove him from office in retaliation for that ruling. Well, the judge wasn't up for retention that year, or the next year, for several years thereafter. And by the time he was up for retention, the union had moved on to other issues. Tempers had cooled. The atmosphere was different. The issues were different. And, in fact, a retention election didn't get mounted. So, deciding high-profile cases is a difficult thing for a judge to do at any time, but it's especially difficult when the judge is facing an imminent retention election. And, again, I know, Senator Taylor, this is not new information for you. But we do believe it would be a backward step to move towards, a step towards at least appearing that cases could be decided more in favor of the powerful litigants in accordance with the law to increase the frequency of retention elections. Another more frequent campaigns against judges standing for election are a predictable effect of more frequent retention elections since tempers and issues will have less time to be moved from the spotlight into a more longer-term perspective. And as campaigns are mounted against judges, you can expect that judges can and will mount counter-campaigns. Well, the issue of judicial fundraising and judicial campaigning has become a national issue in this country. I recently heard a comment from the Texas Supreme Court Justice Tom Phillips, who indicated that he raised and spent over $2 million in his last judicial campaign. When we have a situation where that kind of fundraising is necessary and is going on, we are also getting a situation where the neutrality of our judges is being called into question. And I do think that it is a move backwards. We see over 150,000 cases come into the court system every year, and only a few of them, only a handful of them, get to be controversial. And judges need to be, yet each case, even if the non-controversial ones, are very important to the litigants involved in the case. The judges need to be evaluated at a regular paced interval about how they're handling all their cases, not just their highly visible case.
One other point I want to make is that aside from judicial independence concerns, which I think are really serious, this may seem like a small change, but in fact it's a very large change. Shortening the period between retention elections also would have the effect of disqualifying qualified applicants from seeking judicial positions. It decreases the period of job security and the likelihood that a political campaign is going to be mounted against a judge. Right now, our judicial salaries are falling with reference to salaries in other states, and we have some law clerks who leave the court going to work for large law firms and are already making more money than Superior Court judges on the bench now. An experienced private sector attorney might be making twice or three times what he or she would make on the bench. If we take the period of retention if we go through retention elections more frequently and reduce job security, it's even less likely that we're going to get those really qualified people who are seeking judicial positions. In our position, I'd just like to end, in our position paper, we do state a quote from Edward Madeira, who chaired the ABA's Commission on Separation of Powers and Judicial Independence. And Mr. Madeira said, judicial independence is not for the protection of judges, but it's for the protection of the public. We do feel that protecting the structural integrity of our system is paramount and that this resolution should not move forward. I'd be pleased to answer the questions you may have.
Thank you very much. I don't have any. Justice Rabinowitz, did you wish to follow up?
We have a special, Mr. Chairman, special batting order, and I think Mr.
Cotton's Mr. Cotton sixth, okay. Then I have two people on the teleconference, Mr. Cotton and Mr. Gara. And I'll call on you, gentlemen, just as soon as we've concluded the next two witnesses. Right ahead.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, my name is Bill Cotton. I'm the director of the Judicial Council. The Council is, of course, an independent agency in the judicial branch of government that participates in the selection of judges, evaluates judges up for retention, and makes its recommendations and information known to the public, and does other projects involving the administration of justice. I think it can all be summed up as the Council's job is to try to assure as much excellence in the judicial branch and the judiciary specifically as it can. And that involves primarily balancing judicial accountability and judicial independence. I don't just talk about judicial accountability here. I talk before the judges in their annual conferences as well, and it is very important. Judges exercise a tremendous amount of authority, not only on constitutional issues, but divorces, dissolutions, proceedings where a parent can lose custody of their children. It is critically important that they be, that they work hard, that they be relatively smart, that they be fair, that they don't carry their personal prejudices into their cases. The Judicial Council does a more thorough evaluation of judges and makes more information public than any other state in this country and, in fact, any other country in the world. We are a model for other states, and I've been asked to provide information on how we do things to places as far as way as Georgia. And I don't mean the state of Georgia, I mean the Republic of Georgia, the former Soviet Union. We are a model. We do surveys across the board of police officers, attorneys, jurors, child protection workers. Do we recommend against judges frequently? No. But I sincerely believe just the fact that we do this oversight tends to keep judges more responsive to the electorate. And that is one of the real basic things about the Judicial Council, that is judicial accountability. But an equally important concept is judicial independence. One of the basic principles on which this country was founded was judicial independence, the need to protect the citizens based on their constitutional rights, even if it's not the popular thing currently, or even if the powers that be would just as soon forget a particular constitutional amendment. Sometimes that cuts one way, sometimes it cuts another, and certainly our judiciary is not infallible. But that concept of judicial independence is very important, and I don't believe it's inconsistent with judicial accountability. The Council opposes shortening retention terms
because it believes that it would upset that balance between judicial accountability. It does believe that it would make it harder to get applicants, and it is critical that we get quality applicants. That's no matter how good the Judicial Council does its job, no matter how well the governor picks or whatever process, if you don't get the quality applicants, you're not going to get good judges. By decreasing the stability of the job, you're going to particularly have less incentive for quality private practitioners to apply for these positions. It will, of course, increase our costs, not a great deal in terms of the state budget, but there will be increased costs. It also will, by putting more judges on the ballot each election, I think it decreases the focus that we and the electorate is to bring against individual judges. Also like to point out, while, for example, Superior Court judges are up once every 6 years now, the Judicial Council does do a preliminary evaluation 2 years before then. So we do an attorney and peace officer survey not only once every 6 years, but twice every 6 years, once 2.5 years and then once a half year before the election. So there already is more than just the evaluation every 6 years. I'm glad to try to answer any questions that you might have, but I'm trying to keep my remarks
brief. Thank you, Mr. Cotton. We always appreciate your good words. I did want to note for the record that the other evening I was channel surfing and came upon C-SPAN, and there was a judicial conference going on down south. I don't remember exactly where it was, but the subject was judicial qualifications, selection, and election of judges. And upon that panel, we had Justice Dana Fabe, who comported herself very well, I felt, and very professionally. And it was obvious, I watched the program for about 45 minutes, it was very obvious to me that the people in the audience were quite enamored both with her and the answers she was giving to the questions, but more than that, were quite excited and interested in a system of justice that was to them like talking about something on the backside of the moon. They were coming from states like Georgia and Louisiana and others where direct election of judges has been routine for years, and where they've been indicting judges and throwing them in jail and doing other things with them down there for years, too. And these people were so shocked that a system would exist where quality, accountability, background checks had something to do with the appointment to the bench, that she was asked a whole series of questions of the entire panel. No one received the questions that she did. And they were very fascinating answers to those people, because the idea of not supporting your local judge in the every two-year election process or whatever seemed very refreshing to them. And I just wanted to note from the record, I was very proud of the job that she did on TV down there and with that panel, and was very proud of our state at the time, because it certainly showed a lot of respect by others for the system that we have, and lends great credibility, at least to me, on the comments that you've made about how this is a model system. So thank you very much for those comments.
Thank you.
Are you up, Justice?
Thank you,
your turn.
Chairman. Senator Taylor, I want to thank you for your comments. I think you've identified and highlighted what the constitutional framers of the Alaska Constitution intended. In my view, it was a brilliant compromise between the federal system, elected system, and the merit system. And the experiment worked, in my view. If I can answer Mr. Pauly's statement, the system is not broke. The system is working, and it's working brilliantly. I've devoted 40 years of my life to this judicial system, and this judicial system has been corruption-free in terms of the judge's performance of his or her judicial duties. And it's a tribute to the screening that the Judicial Council does and the care that the Judicial Council takes in the selection process and sending up
very, very able candidates for each judicial vacancy. I just want to reemphasize that now that the committee substitute is in place, maybe my remarks are redundant, but in my view, the system has worked, and it's a reflection of Turner's concept of the new frontier. Well, it has been a new frontier for the Alaska judiciary. We've attracted talented lawyers who don't have political power, who don't have old family connections. It's really the philosophy of the West. If you have talent and you've made a record, you can apply for and obtain a judicial position in most cases. But it's up to the individual. The individual can control his or her destiny to a large extent. And that's the brilliance of the founding fathers' compromise between an elective system and this merit selection, merit retention. And also I want to reemphasize one other thing that Bill Cotton said. The Alaska electorate gets more information on the performance of judges than any other political entity in the country. The Alaska, and that's the theory of democracy. An educated electorate is what we want, and that's what we're getting. Now, I know there's a movement to truncate the, now that we have the committee substitute, truncate the retention period. But just remember this. Initially, when a person is appointed to a judicial position, she or he has to run within 3 years. There you have your speedy evaluation and analysis of the judicial officer's performance. And this is taken from all walks of life, from the police, from probation officers, from public hearings, and from who else knows the judges better than the lawyers, and from the judges themselves. We have a very elaborate and methodology that has worked. And what truncating the period of evaluation, let's say, for the Supreme Court, and I'm going to end here, you're overlooking one thing. When I was attacked, or I was attacked, because I wrote a decision that a group of physicians in Anchorage thought was too favorable to the patients in malpractice cases. Okay, so at the last minute, they mounted a campaign, and I almost got defeated. The next time up, again, I was opposed in 10 years. And what is the detriment or the minus here is I had to go and combat, because I love the job that I had, last-minute attack. So I have to go to what group do I know? The attorney. And who did I go to? All over the state. I don't know attorneys in each position, so I had chairpersons. And I really didn't even want to know who my chairpersons were. And I never looked at the list of contributors. But you've got to maintain the appearance of impartiality. And you know, this is one of the trade-offs. This is the accountability. The electorate knew my writing skills. They knew my vote on the malpractice case. They knew my vote on sentence appeal. And it was a very informed electorate, and I had to combat it. But I was uneasy, frankly, because the appearance of the thing, I had to go and have chairpersons and get up some sort of rebuttal. Well, in summation, I think that the stress on judges is terrible in a way, but it's warranted because it's a trade-off between a merit selection, merit retention, and accountability. And we accept it. We live with it. And it's a real strain, but I think this system has worked. And I congratulate the committee on adopting a committee substitute. We have a great system, and as you identified, there are judges, there are lawyers, there are citizens who want this system that Alaska has and hunger for it. And let's keep it as it is. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have two people on the teleconference. That's first, Mr. Les Gara.
Thank you, Chairman Taylor. I'm in private practice up in Anchorage. Can you hear me? Because we're having a hard time hearing you up here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, you're coming in loud and clear.
Okay, thank you. I'm in private practice in Anchorage. I've been here for a bit over a decade. I actually came up at the invitation of Justice Rabinowitz, who just spoke in the 1980s to clerk for him. And what I have to say echoes in fair part what Justice Rabinowitz said. Before this legislature decides to disrupt the compromise that the 55 delegates of the Constitutional Convention made in 1955, before you decide to disrupt the compromise, I would really urge you to take a look and see what they debated and how much in detail they debated the system they decided to adopt. On the issue of electoral influence upon the judiciary, Delegate Ed Davis said in 1955, quote, "All of us here want an independent judiciary, a judiciary that will not be swayed by public will at any particular moment, a judiciary that will not be subject to any political pressure. We've taken the best means devised yet to appoint and select qualified judges and to keep judges free from outside political pressures and to get rid of judges who are not able to properly do their job." They considered all of the competing proposals at that time in 1955, elections, frequency of elections, how to appoint judges, do we give the governor and the legislature veto power or exceptional influence over the judiciary, and they reached a compromise that's worked very well. I, too, am happy that this committee has decided to drop the other provisions of SJR 15, but the remaining provision also increases the amount of public pressure on the judiciary beyond what the delegates in 1955 agreed to and thought was appropriate. There was an earlier statement by an aide for Senator Lehman who said, "What we have here is a system that's broken that has judges bring in their political biases and their personal biases and decide cases based on their personal biases." That's not actually what happens. One of the court decisions that spurred the predecessor to SJR 15 was a decision by Judge Mahofsky in Anchorage that lent some support to the idea that maybe homosexual marriage was legal under Alaska law. Judge Mahofsky's personal biases, if that's what would have motivated his decision, and if he allowed that to motivate his decision, would have caused him to say that gay marriage is not allowed, that it should be illegal. There's a fair sense that that's what Judge Mahofsky's personal biases are. But what Judge Mahofsky did was what he should have done. He decided the case based upon what he believed the law was. I'm not sure if he was correct about the law or incorrect about the law, but what's gratifying is that he didn't decide the case based on his personal biases. He decided the case based on what he thought the law required. There are other issues that judges have been vilified for by one political group on one end of the spectrum or another on the other end of the spectrum. I know that some of the legislature are not happy about the Supreme Court's decision on abortion a number of years ago, but that court had to make the decision that it made, not based on any personal bias, but we in Alaska, we have here a constitutional right to privacy, and they had to follow what the Constitution said. Every single court, conservative or liberal, throughout the country that has addressed the question of whether or not abortion is legal in light of a constitutional provision that protects privacy has said that it's legal. They had to decide the case the way they did because of what our Constitution said. And if our Constitution said something different, then their decision would be something different. The Supreme Court a number of years ago did something. You know, the Supreme Court has been targeted by many as being maybe a liberal body. The liberals claim that it's a conservative body. A number of years ago, the Supreme Court held that the rural subsistence preference provision that we had was unconstitutional. That decision wasn't based on judges' personal biases. It was based on the majority of the court's view of what the law said, again. Let me just get close to finishing here. When I show up in front of the legislature, when a political issue is being debated, I want a politically biased decision. If I'm proposing a liberal cause, I want a liberal result. If somebody's proposing a conservative cause, they want a conservative result. That is what the legislature does. It debates politics. In court, I don't want a judge who's going to decide a case based on how the soundbite of his or her decision is going to look in the paper the next day. I want a judge to consider all the facts and all the law, even if those things can't be summarized in a sexy soundbite. And by increasing the number of retention elections, what we're going to do is we're going to encourage judges who are not as strong-willed as maybe they should be, but encourage judges who want to keep their jobs to issue soundbite decisions. And that's what worries me. And that's what worried the framers in 1955. And that's why they selected the compromise that they selected. And I would ask that this committee give a lot of thought to what was considered in 1955 by our 55 delegates before changing the compromise that they had agreed upon at that time. Thank you very much. I have nothing else to say unless anybody has any questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Garr. I appreciate you taking the time, and thank you for your patience in waiting up there. Mr. Bundy, Dave, are you there?
Yes, I am, Senator.
Go right ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm David Bundy. I've been an attorney in Alaska since 1972, and I'm currently in my sixth year as a member of the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar Association. And like the other speakers, I do not believe that the legislature should adopt the committee should adopt the resolution as currently proposed. It's, of course, better, I think, than the resolution that was originally proposed. But even so, I don't think there's any reason to be shortening the retention terms for members of the judiciary. If we were starting from scratch, we could debate what the right number of years is between retention elections. And, you know, you could argue legitimately in favor of one year or another. But what we have now is a system that, as far as I can see, has worked well since it was initiated, and the impetus to change it is wrongly headed, in my view. It's headed from the perspective that judges are off doing their own thing, not paying attention to the law, not following the rules that judges are supposed to follow. But really, when there are litigants, somebody wins, somebody loses. And the losing side may have a feeling that the judge has made a bad decision. I've had that feeling about judges, and I've read appellate decisions that I thought were poor and badly reasoned, even if I wasn't involved in them. This is the nature of the adversary process. There will be unhappy litigants, and there will be members of the public who object to decisions. That doesn't say that the judges are not doing their job. That just says the judges are doing their job, because they're deciding difficult issues on which people have strong feelings. That is what they are there for. Justice Marshall said in the 18th century or the 19th century that it is the duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. And when they exercise that duty, people are going to be unhappy. There isn't any evidence that I'm aware of that judges are in need of additional restraints upon their power. They have little enough as it is. They can't appropriate money. They can't send troops. They can't do anything that the other departments of government can do. All they can do is submit reasoned arguments and support their decisions with precedent and analysis. And this is what we ask people to do for, frankly, considering the alternatives available to them, not much money. To make the job less attractive by threatening their job security more than it already is not the way to get better judicial candidates. And to subject them to the possibility of elections in which they will have to engage in fundraising is, you know, undesirable in the extreme. Because as Justice Rabinowitz said, the only people who will contribute money to judicial candidates are lawyers. And if we want a system that they have in some states where the plaintiff's lawyers support certain judges in order to get them elected, so they can get good rulings for their clients against the defense attorneys and the insurance companies, we don't want to head in that direction. I don't think anyone should want that. We need people who are independent of organized interest groups, organized political groups, and anything that we do to degrade that independence is just plain bad policy. So we should not move in this direction, Mr. Chairman. That's all I have to say.
David, thank you. It's good to hear from you.
Thank you.
And again, we appreciate your patience in standing by up there all this time. Was there anyone else here who wished to testify on Senate Joint Resolution number 15? I have, for the information of those on the teleconference network, long since lost a quorum around here as the Finance Committee, if you're watching TV, they're probably on it right now, is back in session. at this point, we were allowed to continue, I might add, to take testimony even though the quorum had gone because we weren't contemplating any further action and haven't taken any, and so the evidence, or I should say the record, is preserved, and we now have that much behind us. These bills will matters will probably come up before the committee again next Monday. I don't believe we're going to have a committee meeting on Friday. So with that, we're adjourned. Thank you.